This is Leslie Thompson Sasso, oral history interview with Mr. Brian Mathis, a longtime resident of Venice, Illinois. Today is October 18th, 2016. So how did your family come to reside in Venice?
My grandmother migrated from the South, Clarksdale, Mississippi, and then she moved in what's called Madison at the time. So when my mother was born, they moved into the projects, Lee Wright Home, which is considered North Venice.
What made your grandmother pick Venice as a place to live, moving up from the South?
I really have no idea how she actually ended up here. As people migrated, I guess they stayed wherever they fit in, you know, and so, or they felt they had the greatest opportunity. And so I guess that's why she ended up here.
Okay. You said that your family moved into the projects and that there were two projects here in Venice. There were the Lee Wright homes and then eventually there were the Venice homes.
Correct.
Can you describe what the housing project was like, your memories of growing up there?
Well, first of all, there's a train trestle down the street there, and that was the dividing line, the color line, for lack of better words. And the Lee Wright homes were right to the north of that. And then you have the Venice homes, which were, it's a vacant lot right over here. That's where the Venice homes used to be. There's one apartment building still there, but that was not part of the Venice homes. But that is the area where the Venice homes were. So the government controlled the Lee Wright homes, and the Lee Wright homes were like a little city as far as I was concerned. It had everything basically you needed. It had a rec center there. Head Start was there. Then there were other schools. Dunbar, Blair was there for kindergarten through, I think, fifth grade. And then after fifth grade, seventh on up till eighth. No, what is it? Sixth, seventh, and eighth went to Dunbar. And then after that, you went to Madison. When my parents... Where you live depends on how much money you had and how many kids you had in your family. So at the time, my parents were on government assistance at the time, and so we were placed down here in the Lee Wright homes. And my grandmother lived in the Lee Wright homes. So, and then all my friends, and you know, so it was really nice. I didn't know any better. I never knew I was poor. Really didn't care. I just had fun and all our needs were met, and that's the only thing we really cared about as kids. So I never understood the color issues. I never understood why I couldn't go past the train trestle back there. But if I did go past that train trestle, you got in a lot of trouble.
What happened if you passed it? Like, were there, did your parents tell you not to go past it? Or was it just a, like a social norm you knew not to go past it? Or
both.
Okay.
Because my cousin and I, one day, because I didn't understand it, I think I was about seven or eight, I rode my bike up to the train trestle. And my uncle, who was actually getting off the bus right here, outside on the sidewalk, saw me from that, me and my cousin, that far away, all the way down there. And I got a spanking and punished, and because he saw us.
What types of kind of things were told to you about not going on that other side of the tracks? Like, was it just like stay away, or was it things are going to happen to you? Or,
well, I can almost remember. I can hear his voice almost really. He said, "I'm like, what's the big deal, Uncle JB, about us going on the other side?" He said, "Because you can just simply come up missing." That's all he said.
Really?
And that's what they would always say to us. You don't need to be in areas you're not supposed to be because you simply just come up missing. You know, and I guess that was in reference to the Emmett Till, what happened to Emmett Till. So I didn't know anything about Emmett Till until I was grown. They still know, all they did was give you an overtone of, you know, they basically kept you shielded from the worst, you know. Even when Martin Luther King got shot, my grandmother just like, she said, I knew somebody was going to eventually get him, you know. And that's not the term, her exact words was, I knew somebody was eventually going to kill that N-word.
Mm.
That's what she said.
Wow.
Yeah.
Emmett Till was a very, you know, prolific moment in history, in civil rights history, because that was, you know, really this first instance that went, you know, public in the news.
Right.
So that, you know, growing up as an African American in the 50s and 60s, Till was murdered in 55, that was never really addressed? Or do you think it was something that was always in the back of your parents' mind because you lived in a community that was, like you mentioned, you know, split?
For the most part, it, you know, we didn't know about violence and stuff. We didn't see a lot of television. We weren't allowed to watch certain things, you know. We never, hardly ever watched the news as kids. So we didn't know what was going on in the media and in the public. Our world was basically that side. And even when we would come up here to the park, we knew there was segregation in the park. We knew that people would look at you funny, white people, and I'm talking about the blacks. So, but still, they would tolerate, you know, us being there, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, like I said, because I was having fun, and I let, my parents always said, let the grown-ups deal with the grown-up issues. You just stay a kid. And that's what we did. We let the grown-ups handle all that stuff. So we really wasn't aware of racial issues that were going on. I remember a lot of stuff, just like when we were talking about that. But being at such a young age, it's like, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so.
When you went to the park, you mentioned that, you know, sometimes whites would look at you funny. Were there any instances in Venice where you could actually see Jim Crow segregation, like signs that said, to your memory?
This used to be gas station right here on the corner. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother said they didn't take that sign down in 1963. Now, I was born in 59, so me being four. But I never physically saw it or remember it, but it was there. So the signs were there, and as you know, stuff is especially slow to change in small towns. But the people of Venice were quiet about and very subdued about how they dealt with issues of racism and stuff like that. You know, they weren't like in the South where people are all in your face and, you know, stuff like that. They were here would just look at you and make you feel very uncomfortable, let you know you weren't welcome in that area. That's how they would do it.
Okay. So if you were born in 69, I know that Kennedy
59.
Came, or 59, I'm mm-hmm. sorry. Kennedy came through in 60.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember your parents or your grandparents, like as you were growing up, ever discussing that mm-hmm. at all?
I knew people loved him. They loved him and his brothers and everything. That's all I knew.
Mm-hmm.
They had, you know, never really talked. Like I said, my parents really and grandmothers really didn't talk politics much at all.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So the housing projects that you grew up in, the Lee Wright Homes,
yes.
That was basically like a self-contained community for only African Americans in Venice. So did you feel like...
Yeah, because stuff was real segregated back then.
Right.
Yeah.
And so did you feel like that community provided you with like a good upbringing? Like you had a positive time there.
Oh, yeah, I had fun.
Yeah.
Every day, you know. You know, you might get into a couple of fights or something. That'd be the most that, you know, but, you know, being, it was a lot of people in the projects back then. You mm-hmm. know, you're talking about like about 2,000, 2,500 people lived in the projects over there in that small four block area, you know, so.
Wow, because it's changed a lot now.
Yes, it's but... not, it's only a fourth of the size. There's brand new ones there now. It's a fourth of the size of what it used to be.
Wow.
Same amount of land, they just spread it out, made it a little bit more posh, mm-hmm. and spread it out, but less people, far less people.
So when do you think that, so for your elementary school experiences, mm-hmm. you were with all of your friends from Lee Wright Homes. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then I noticed that in the 1960s, even though you were small, certain cities in Madison County, Venice included, were facing this challenge of integrating, not only just schools, but housing, even the community pool. Did you feel any of this tension growing up here?
Just a little bit. They, you know, as long as you were in your area by nightfall, like they said, when the lights came on, be in your area. You know, as long as you were there, you were tolerated. You didn't get too much hassle when I was growing up. You know, my brothers and I used to walk up to downtown Madison to shop and buy stuff. They had the 10-cent store. But then Granite City, which is on up the road, now they were a lot more in your face and would, you know, you really come up missing in Granite City. So, you know, they didn't allow us to go there. And if we did go to Granite, you had to be 5 to 7 strong, no less. Because you come up missing, so you knew it was there, but you were taught what to do, where to be, and how to conduct yourself.
Were there any stories that you remember hearing growing up, like you mentioned, like that you would come up missing? Like, were there any instances of where that happened? where your parents, you know, were able to kind of say to you, like, if you do this.
You mean blacks being abducted in this area?
Yeah.
No, I've never heard any of them.
It was just kind of like this social, like, norm that...
Yeah, you had more regular kind of crime, murder, gangsters, all that kind of stuff going on, more so than the racial issues.
In Venice itself?
Yeah, Venice, Madison, not even with Granite City. People just... stayed out of pretty much out of Granite City. And then, like, East St. Louis was going through the biggest because I had relatives in East St. Louis. That was the one where people basically, like, threw, like, a flock of birds. They just fluttered and just up and moved really quickly. You know, they, a lot of times they would just leave the house and just move. But that wasn't the case here in Venice and Madison. People just slowly and gradually moved out quietly.
So what was the first job that you had in Venice growing up?
The first job I had in Venice was that of a paper boy for 2/3 of the city of Venice. And it covered roughly, I'll say about almost 10 miles by the time you got through walking up and down every street on both sides of the street. And all of the city dignitaries lived where the school superintendents down by the high school, and the principal, the mayor, which lives just catty corner to City Hall. All of this all the way down to that train trestle, all the way down to that train trestle. Everything back that way belonged to me.
Okay. And what was the most difficult part about being a paper boy? That was a big route.
Yeah, a real big route. And I tried to break it up. They said when they did finally break it up, they had to get 3 paper boys to do what I was doing. It was just too big. But... the hardest part was collecting money, because when people didn't pay their bill, it directly came off. The paper got paid off the top, and you got your money once you got through collecting everything from everyone. So that means a lot of times I didn't get paid. And to do that for 3 years, there would sometimes be months and I never got paid, because the people were, by being so large, everybody that didn't pay me, or if they would stop their service and not do it properly, all that came directly out of my pay. And as the older I got, and the more I realized I basically was working for nothing, I quit. Well, and the main thing that made me quit, I forget what year it was, we had a really bad snowstorm. The snow was 4 feet deep. And on Saturday night, people would always look for their paper. And if it took me to 1 o'clock in the morning to finish my route, that's what I would do. I would stay out there until I got finished. And people would actually look for me, because they knew that for 3 years, every Saturday they got their paper, or early Saturday morning. Sunday morning. And there were some mornings, because the paper came late, that I was up at 5 a.m. delivering paper. People were very adamant about their papers in this community. So I was over on Robin Street, and the snow, by being so high, was level. You couldn't see any terrain. And so I didn't see this hole, which had to be at least 2.5 feet deep. So when I fell into it, it went up under my coat all the way up to my chest. And not only crawling out of the hole, still had 20, 30 papers. Sunday papers are heavy too. By the time I got here, I sat on a radiator for 2 hours because I was so cold. And that was the turning point. Now, after that, I couldn't take anymore.
How old were you when you were the paper 15? Boy? 15?
When I finally quit, 15.
Okay. And so now you were covering most of Venice at that point. So you were leaving the projects where you grew up, and you were delivering into, like, all different parts.
We had moved around the corner from the projects on Jefferson in 1973. We moved up to Venice from North Venice to South Venice in 1969. In 1973, we moved from 71 Venice Apartments to 507 Jefferson, which was around the corner. And when we lived up in the Lee Wright homes, we lived in 90 and 95 Venice homes. And so then when we left there, we moved to 90 and 95 Lee Wright homes. Okay. And then when I was looking up the other day, Lee, which was Mayor Lee, that's where the Lee came from. And Wright was another prominent, I'm not sure if he's an alderman or whatever, but evidently they were the ones that had a lot to do with bringing the projects to that area. And they said Mayor Lee, when he was the mayor, got a lot done for the city of Venice. So
now you delivered papers to Mayor Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And then now you delivered into areas that were like predominantly white neighborhoods as well, or?
It was very few. Matter of fact, there weren't any blacks over when I delivered papers. There weren't any blacks in this area over here at all.
So did you feel any, like, were you, did you feel safe?
Yeah.
Because you had mentioned, like, before.
Everybody knew me.
Everybody knew you. So that gave you this sense of security. And you didn't feel any of that racial tension when you were delivering papers?
I never felt any racial tension in Venice.
Never? Okay.
No, not when we moved up here. It was a little bit, you know, we'd have projects, maybe a couple of the kids or mm-hmm. whatever, you know, but I never felt any racial tension. I mean, I wasn't an angel my own self, you know. I got into mischief. Some of it is like I actually was a bully one time in my life, and I had to go back and do that again. I bullied a little girl. And if I could, if I ever found that girl again, I would beg her for forgiveness and apologize, because now I hate bullies. I was bullied too, but the fact that I was once a bully, now I don't like them at all, and I stand up to bully. I actually come to somebody else's aid because I know what it's like to be a bully and be bullied, and I don't, you know, I just don't like it. It was wrong. My mother took me to the girl's house, made me apologize to her and her parents. And I was never, you know, and after that, I never did anything to anybody after that. And, you know, my mother back then, my mother made you see what you was doing was wrong, because one of the first questions they asked was, why are you picking on her? And I had no answer. And I had no logical answer. And I felt like the biggest dummy. I felt like I was mean. Went to church every Sunday, so then I felt evil. And after my mother got through talking to me and taking me over there, that forever changed me.
The reason why I asked about, like, you feeling safe as paperboy was, you know, you had mentioned that, you know, when your friends and yourself wanted to travel into places like Granite City, that you would have to go with at least 5 or 6 or 7 of you to travel safely. And you had mentioned that, you know,
Granite City was and still is very racist.
Yeah.
You know, where Venice was prejudiced. You know, there were a few bigots here, but not to the point where they were just out and out racist. And as I've grown older, I've learned the difference between prejudice, bigotry, and racism. The two dangerous are bigotry and racism. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody is prejudiced to some form or some degree. But when you implement those other two, now you're talking about influencing and causing havoc on another person's life. And so Venice was just basically prejudice with a little bit of bigotry. Granite City is bigoted and racist.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that you had to travel with, you know, these 5 to 7 people, because you had said that there were instances, or you might have remembered an instance where, like, people would try to take children.
The younger kids, when we lived in North Venice. Okay, in that time. And at that time, hobos and everything, because the railroad tracks were right there. So you had hobos, transits, some of everything coming right through there, because that that was a truck route, you know, going in and out of the depot, you know. And then you had escape routes, which is what is now Route 3 right here, was a levee. And on behind it was a place called an island. And that's where you come up missing it, for real. You know, and that's what we were talking about a minute ago, where they would come in and snatch kids, and then, you know. But the community was tight, very tight-knit, so you always watched out for each other. Unlike today's society and today's neighborhoods, you only had each other, so people kind of watched out for each other, you know, to a certain extent. You still had a lot of rivalry and stuff going on, but you still had, when the issue came down to self-preservation, it was more prominent then, you know. Nothing like it is now.
Yeah.
So, and so the issues of, like, the whites didn't really come down there unless they needed something, and they had no reason really come down there, really. But on North Venice, there was still a lot of white families down there, and store owners and stuff like that. and never had any problems or anything. So when we moved up here to North to South Venice into the Venice homes, that was a lot of fun too. I mean, you know, and as we got to know all the families and everything, especially me being a paperboy, the time I came a paperboy, and because I had all these houses, basically at one time or another, every house on this end of Venice was on my route. So that meant every individual in Venice, if they didn't know my name, they knew my face. And all you have to do for a lot of people is say, do you remember the colored paperboy? That was me. You know, so I was the only one, to my knowledge. I delivered the Metro East Journal. And that was a prominent paper. It covered all the counties, you know, all the way up to Springfield. Had a wide range of everything from sports to everything. Where the Post-Dispatch and the, what was the other one, Globe Democrat, where they stopped and what they covered in Missouri, the Metro East Journal covered on this side of the river.
Okay.
So.
Oh, interesting. So you said you delivered to most of the people in Venice. Mm-hmm. And so Mayor Lee, who lived across the street from this building, was a longtime mayor of Venice.
Mm-hmm. He was mayor when I was delivering papers, but he never knew my name. He would just say the paper boy. Everybody just called me a little colored paper boy.
And did that bother you at all? Or
no.
Okay. All right. Mayor Lee was part of this like larger kind of, upon like looking at him as a political figure, he was part of this larger Madison County and Venice political machine.
Right.
In particular, he was accused of not promoting any type of like anti-poverty legislation or helping people that needed help in the late 60s and early 70s. Do you remember any of those accusations, or did the people in Venice react at all? Or
that was one issue they said. They let the adults take care of the grown-up stuff.
You know,
they never, the parents, they were really adamant about that, kids being kids and staying out of adult affairs. Matter of fact, if anything was going on sensitive like that, unless there was a need to know, they would have sent you out of the room. You weren't even allowed to be in the room while serious issues were being discussed with adults. It just was unheard of back then.
What other childhood activities were you involved in besides the paper route?
Childhood?
Yeah, or even like into adolescence, like what?
You know, they had, in the summertime, we learned how to swim, and they took us, you come up here in the morning time to the rec center up here, and then they take you to the depot where we learned to swim. That was a summer thing they had, park program they had for a little while, 2 or 3 years. Other than that, we just played, rode our bikes, climbed trees, BB guns, all the stuff that old-fashioned kids used to get into.
Right. Were you involved in any other type of activities like Boy Scouts here?
Oh, I forgot about Boy Scouts. Yeah, I went through, my brothers and I, we would start out with Cub Scouts. I was a Weeblo, and Richard and Pat Foote were the Scout Masters. They covered everything from Bobcat all the way up until the Weeblos. And then they were Mr. Tolliver, and he lived on the street, 123 down from Mr. Lee. Mr. Tolliver, he was over Boy Scout troop, and they had their own building and everything. Actually one of the better Boy Scout troops in the area down here. And I did that for 2 years. No, 3 years, excuse me. I think I stopped that when I was 16, so. But anyway, so I went from Weeblo to Boy Scouts, and got to go to Camp Sunning, which is down in Potosi. The council still uses that campsite for their summer gatherings and stuff. So, yeah, that was pretty cool. Learned a lot.
And you had mentioned that you guys were the only African-American Boy Scouts in your troop.
Yeah.
And how was your experience?
Pat Foote and Richard Foote didn't allow any kind of division.
Okay.
They didn't allow any issues of color or race to come up. They were there to teach boys to get along. Actually, stay true to what scouting was all about. Doesn't matter race, creed, or color. But when I got up to the Boy Scout levels and being the only black Boy Scout over there, that became somewhat of an issue. I was kind of shunned and left in the corner and kind of, you know. And he would have his son, Jack, Mr. Tolliver was that, Jack, would you spend some time with him? I can't make the other boys spend any time with him or work with him. He said, but I'm asking you. And I heard him pull his son to the side and ask him that. And Jack said, yeah. And when we all through high school, Jack Tolliver was always thought very highly of him because of that, you know. So Mr. Tolliver, I think his hands were kind of tied, because a lot of the Boy Scouts, their parents were the more affluent people of Venice, if it was such a thing, you know. But
you know. And is that growing up for you? Did that, like you mentioned, like when you were in the homes or even when you moved, like you were just, you know, kids and you played and you had fun and, you know, you were part of all of these activities. Was that the first instance for you where you started to kind of feel that kind of subversive?
Oh no! The going back to when we lived here in North Venice, on Saturday mornings we get up and watch TV, watch Captain Kangaroo. You saw Romper Room, and I always noticed that you never saw any black children anywhere on television. And I noticed when you go to the stores, you never saw any black mannequins. You know, everything that you saw was white, and so I kept asking my father, how come you never see anything black? And my father was kind of at a loss for words. And I remember one time I said, after watching TV and everything was white, and I think we were going through a rough time at the house, and I said, I wish I was white. And my father got really, really ticked off at me, and you know, and he backhanded me. And I'm like, I didn't understand why he got so mad for me saying that. And he didn't ask me why I said it. My father didn't lose his temper. For the most part, he always calm. And that was my first time ever seeing my father just lash. I mean, naturally, that scared me half to death, because I'm like, you know, my father just didn't, he didn't hit you with his hand, you know. And so that was a wake-up call then. And I forget how old I was, but I wasn't even 10. I wasn't even 10. But that's when I started realizing prejudice and racism and segregation and all that kind of stuff then. But the thing that bothered me was they had no answers. You know, they didn't tell me why, you know. And so as you grow older, you learn. But see, as a black kid growing up in so much of a USA, even by today's standards, you were told what you couldn't do, where you couldn't go, what you couldn't have or wasn't supposed to have, you know, what you couldn't be or never be, you know. And so all that stuff stuck with me. And even to the point when I went to the military, and I remember I was over in Italy, and I saw the coolest chessboard I ever seen in my life. This chessboard was onyx, marble, pewter, silver, and bronze. It was made up in this, like castles with knights and everything. So the board was actually made up off the ground, and around it was rocks and hills, like you had to infiltrate a castle, you know. Just magnificent, beautiful. So it came in three different sizes, ranging from $200 all the way up to $750. Okay. So I wanted the middle one, which is, I think, around $375. My girlfriend at the time, black woman, I'm from St. Louis, said, black people don't have that kind of stuff. What would you do with it? You don't even play chess. And that immediately, I didn't get mad at her. I got mad at the system, because to me she was brainwashed, and it was going back, it was reinforcing this, black people don't have this, black people don't go here, black people don't know this, and go on and on and on. And so my thing after that kind of stuff was, even growing up in Venice, was I'm going to show you what I can't do, what I can't be, what I can't have, where I can't go. I can show you better than I tell you. And to this day, I regret not buying that chess set. I don't have many regrets in life. That's one of them. And it always bothered me all these years. And I've known a couple of people who went to Italy, and the shop that it was in was right at the base of the Leaning Tower of Pisa. That's where I live, 2 miles from the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And so just the fact that I was over there, lived on the countryside in my own little villa, you know, in the Air Force with two kids, I was single, And I'm like, this right here is an opportunity many people never have. So sure. Once again, let's say where I can't go. I'm already showing you where I am.
Right? Sure.
You know, so.
By the time that you got to high school, mm-hmm. the schools in Venice had been desegregated, however.
Mm-hmm.
Right. However, they were.
That started before 69, though.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it started with this redistribution of busing.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk a little bit about, like, do you remember that, like, in elementary school, vaguely?
Well, I came up here in the fifth grade, and what mm-hmm. they said, they started integrating when I got here. They said they started integrating. It was some blacks actually went to Venice in late 50s, and it was only a couple of them, but they weren't really, because they had the blacks went to Venice Lincoln Technical Center down there, which is now the Venice School. Up the street on Route 3. But when redistricting came up, that's when blacks would move into the school. And I think, I'm not sure, I never heard any stories about when they integrated, the people didn't like it, but they didn't make too big of a fuss of it. The biggest fuss came when Madison had all the problems. Venice didn't want to be associated or made like Madison. So Lee said, let Madison be the blunt of all the negative stuff, and we want to keep our stuff positive. So, but I heard he did his dirt too, but he kept it low key,
mm-hmm.
just like this.
Yeah, I remember reading something in a newspaper. I think it was mm-hmm. the Intelligencer, about how Madison even had like burning crosses when
yeah.
their schools were integrating. Did you hear any
too young?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or any of that friction and. You know, any siblings or family members that were older?
It wouldn't surprise me, but no, I was too young, and then our parents would have shielded us from it. Because you don't want your kids walking around in fear, but you don't want them to be in areas, you don't want to put them in danger, but you don't want them to walk around in fear either. So, you know, they just made sure that we were where we were supposed to be. But when I moved up here to Venice, like I said, we moved up in 69, in the projects, there was not much. The people that they used to integrate Venice originally were from Eagle Park, which was originally, they had the choice to go to Venice or Madison, because technically they were in the Madison School District. But for some reason, because they were not basically in Madison Township or Venice Township, they were in the outskirts, they had the option of which school they wanted to go to. That's where the busing came from.
Okay.
And it was still there when we were there. And it's until they closed the school. So, and I had issues with the people of there. The black kids of Venice had more problems with the black kids of Eagle Park than the white kids did.
Why was that?
I have no idea.
Okay.
They just thought they were tough for some reason. I don't know.
Eagle Park kids thought that they were tough.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that you moved in 1969 up to this part of
right.
Venice.
Mm-hmm.
And at this time, actually in 1969, Venice saw a riot where over 30 black youths firebombed the city, the newspaper says,
mm-hmm.
as an attempt to prevent a black police officer from patrolling the black neighborhoods as he was accused of harassment. Do you recall any of that night's events? Like you said, maybe, like thinking back?
The night that happened, I was at my grandmother's house, because remember all the police, and we weren't allowed to come to the park for months, as a matter of fact, after that happened. They used to have, this over here used to be rides, beautiful park, waterfall, manicured trees with topiary trees and everything, all of it used to be over here, beautiful baseball diamonds, just really beautiful park. And when it got down to the point where they would start giving blacks more access to the park, they took it all out.
Wow.
They shut it down. That's why I say they do subtle protests.
Right.
Instead of making a big riot, or they took it all out.
And do you remember anything from that night, or hearing anything, seeing anything, next day in school, friends talking about it, or?
No. Only thing I remember what little, because they didn't really say, only thing they said was no whites were arrested, they just arrested all blacks, but that was to be expected. And because it was nothing out of ordinary, you know, you knew what was going to happen. It wasn't a big issue, it wasn't a big topic, you know. Okay, you know, what's the next move? You know, everything back then was, how do we progress to make, to slowly implement change to make it better for our people? That's basically, so they didn't harp on things or talk about stuff for a long time. It was too important to just move on. As long as nobody was killed or whatever, you know, you just move on.
Right. Now, in the 60s, what did your parents do for work? Because I know one of the things that was in the newspaper a lot was the NAACP and CORE coming to Venice and talking about how they wanted more African Americans to have opportunities for jobs, be they in local factories or, you know, just anything working.
Well, let me see. Now, the first job I remember my mother having was at the depot, which was a government job. And she didn't keep it very long. My mother bounced around, on jobs. My dad worked up here at the mill, Grand City Steel, where I work. And they would lay him off. Then when they would lay him off, he would go to the National Stockyards up here on Route 3. And he worked at a gas station. He would shovel cow manure, wash out the back of them trailers, what they hauled all the livestock in. Whatever nasty, dirty job that it took for him to take care of his family, that's basically what he did. So he didn't have time to worry about a lot of issues or that kind of stuff because he had five kids and a wife, and, you know, so.
And now your grandmother lived here as well.
Right.
And did she work in the Venice area too, or?
She was a caregiver.
Okay.
And the guy and the people that she care gave basically was in that little project area, so she never had to go very far at all. And that's why I stayed with her a lot, you know. She considered me her baby boy, so that's how much I was older.
Okay. So the NAACP and CORE coming here didn't affect anything.
You gotta understand, in the black community, even more so then as it is now, for change to come about takes great effort and years of perseverance. Okay. And it was the only thing that happens to me fast is when once the laws are laid down, people scatter out of the area, you know. And that's the only thing that everything else comes at a very slow pace. And it's not really talked about until social media came about like it is now. A lot of stuff was just general conversation if somebody wanted to talk politics. And blacks very seldom talk politics.
Okay.
So.
So you started high school in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And even though high school was fully integrated, can you speak to the racial climate of Venice High School in the 70s?
The only thing at the time was there was a little bit of prejudice. As far as any bigotry, I don't know. I know if the teachers were, you never knew it because they never showed it. I had one teacher I felt hated everybody. Name was Mr. Craig. And when I was a freshman, I swore this man hated. When I became a junior, I went to him and asked. I'm a person that can't go to people and confront people. So I asked him, why did you treat me so bad or treat my classmates so bad? And what he said, I found to be true. He said, I cannot stand freshmen and very few sophomores. He said, because your hormones are going crazy. He said, you're complete little idiots. He said, by the time you become a junior and a senior, he said, your demeanor and your attitudes and your maturity has done almost a 180 in just those 2 years. He said, that's when I can tolerate you. I said, well, why are you a freshman English teacher then? He didn't give me an answer either. And he stayed a freshman English teacher. And I never understood that, but he gave me an answer, but that was about the most prejudice I could think of in high school. So that ain't really prejudice. He just didn't like freshmen.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, that's still prejudice, but I mean, he wasn't bigoted. I mean, he was that way towards everybody, you know. And then I had some great teachers, but the only thing about Venice, what I didn't like was you didn't have the opportunities there. It was a very small school. The budget was small. And so it showed. The biggest thing at Venice was basketball and volleyball. And when I first got there, they had track and baseball. and all that stuff eventually slowly went by the wayside as budgets were being cut. Mm. And they always held on to basketball, and that's Venice's claim to fame. They won the state championship in 1973, I think that was. No, 76.
So right as you were in school.
I was on the team.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I was going to ask, what sports did you partake in? So basketball, we know.
Most basketball and track when they had it.
Okay.
Those were the two that I played, I did.
What was it like winning that state championship and all the press? Because that was in every single newspaper.
Man,
that
you really want my opinion on that?
Yeah.
It's going to be totally different than anybody else you talk to in this whole city or state.
Okay, that's great.
And the reason being is because I was on a team and got injured right before the super sectionals, okay? I worked diligently, worked my rear end off to push those first five guys to the players that they were. And I was like the number seven guy on the team. And because I was, like I told the star player, I want your job, I want your position, you know, and that's what I was going for. And I felt I was in reach of taking his position. Maybe they would have finished out the year with them players, but I knew the next year coming back, you know, I would be a force to be reckoned with. My thumb got broke in practice. They missed the ball and hit my thumb. I broke my thumb. And it was like they threw me in a trash can. So I wasn't allowed to travel with the team. When they won the championship, they didn't recognize me. I didn't get to ride in the parade. I didn't get anything. They basically just threw me to the side. And I'm like, what did I do to the coach for the coach to hate me so much? You know, and then none of the players stood up and said anything in my defense. You know, and I got a call last year. We're thinking about having a reunion for the 73 championship team. Well, they remember that I played on the team, but they had forgot that I wasn't allowed to participate when we went to state finals. So when they won the championship and the TV cameras were panning the audience, you know, everybody cheering, only one person in the whole building sat there with a frown on their face and their arms folded, and the TV came straight to me. It was me. I was not happy.
No, I can't imagine.
Because on the other team, it was a guy sitting down there with a cask on his arm.
Why do you think your teammates didn't stand up for you?
They were from Eagle Park, most of them.
Okay.
And then the other white guys were out here, you know, and they didn't want to rock the boat.
So you think that it was,
I was the outsider.
Okay. Were you the only person from Venice that was?
Only black male from Venice, yeah.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. No, I think it might have been one more. No.
Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, they didn't let me dress out, and I wasn't happy. I ain't never been happy. To this day, that's a sore spot, too. Hey, Todd. Yeah, that ticks me off, but I didn't feel that was right. You know, that doesn't show any kind of sportsmanship, mm-hmm. loyalty, and for all the dedication and hard work that I had put in. Like I said, I felt like they just threw me in a trash can.
Sure. After graduation and after that experience, so you were a junior, mm-hmm. and then you graduated in 77. So
I didn't go to Venice my senior year. Because my grades, I was smart enough to enter into a pre-college course, a class called Upward Bound.
Okay.
Upward Bound was held on the college campus of SIU.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so I spent my last year and a half at SIU, and I had good grades when I was up there. Mm-hmm. Got to be a little bit cocky though, because I had good grades even when I was up there,
mm-hmm.
and I missed two of my finals because I got the dates mixed up, and my professor, I begged her to give me 15 minutes to take an hour long test. That's all I need. I know I was that smart. I begged her to give me 15 minutes to take that test, because she knew I would have aced it,
mm-hmm.
and she said, "No, Mr. Mathis, welcome to the adult world. You got to retake the whole class."
Oh my goodness. What was it like then, going from like a junior in high school, you're 16, 17, right?
16.
And then you're going straight to a college campus. Well, what was the environment of SIU like back then in the 70s? Because it was relatively a new college.
It was, now that was, they was bigoted as hell up there, boy, I tell you. But I had so much fun, it ain't even funny.
Really?
Yeah, once again, like they say, when you learn your environment and you mm-hmm. learn to stay in your lane, you just stay in your lane, You know,
okay.
When you confront it with issues of bigotry and racism, you mm-hmm. learn how to overcome them with social, to me, grace and charm. You know, you can make a person look ignorant by showing them kindness and love. You know, and that's what my daddy taught us to handle stuff with. You know, mm-hmm. and so where if somebody doing wrong by you or trying to call you out a name, trying to get a response out of you, and all you doing is showing them, man, you okay? Why are you talking to me this way? You know, I'm like, I understand. Maybe you came up from a family that's poisoned your mind like that, but dude, there's a different way. Well, people don't want to be talked to that way when they trying to spew evil to you. Mm-hmm. So that's always been my defense. If you continue to be ignorant, you know, there's two things you do. Either get away from them or either be more ignorant than them. I always choose to just get away from them.
Yeah. So it was more or less like a culture shock then going to SIU a little bit. As far as like you said,
you're growing up, you're kind of getting into the real world.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of at that time, I was very athletic. The girl said I was very cute. I didn't have much fear, so I was very cocky, you know. So going up to the school, when I saw most of the kids up there, I'm like, so what?
Yeah. What were most of the kids like?
Rich kids were arrogant. Athletes were ignorant. People that was because you had your geeks up there, and I ended up with an entourage up there of about 15 people that followed me around.
Okay.
Now I'm 16 and I got an entourage.
Why do you think that was?
Because of my mouth.
Okay.
I was very in your face, very witty about what I said, and I watched what I said and how I said it. Mm-hmm. So most of the kids were, a lot of them from East St. Louis and Brooklyn, and they were mean and tough. Well, mean and tough in a college atmosphere is not going to get it done. You got to have somebody that's more of a politician mm-hmm. and able to get around the issues and stuff, and that was me.
Okay.
So I still to this day can pretty much talk to anybody about any subject, you know. When I can go from the rich to the poor. So whether you're from the hood or from Harvard, you know, we can sit down and have a conversation.
Yeah.
So.
What at SIU, what was the worst, I guess, maybe experience that you had in dealing with this new population of people?
The worst experience?
Yeah.
The number of girls up there. It was a total distraction.
Okay.
I mean, that was my downfall. Ended up being my downfall. You know, because it took my mind off the studies. At that time, they had all these concerts up there. All these entertainers would come in. All these prestigious people would come through. You know, lawyers, doctors, and they had seminars, free seminars. And so it was just so busy. And then you had the youth hall down. I mean, what's the name center? You know what I'm talking about, where the downstairs where the table tennis and the bowling alley is.
Oh, the Morris University Center.
Yeah.
Called that the Muck.
Yeah. Okay. Then they had the gym, the bubble gym, you know, the pool. Oh, come on. It was just so much stuff to do.
Overwhelming,
it was a
yeah.
whole nother world. So I stayed busy, always into something, couldn't wait to go to school the next day, mm-hmm. you know. But here's the thing about it. If you don't get your studies, then you end up flunking out. And I did fine during the regular part of the year, but what I made a mistake was, because I was so, my grades were so good during the regular part of the year, when summer came, I took all these hard classes. I took a full load, and it had physics and pre-calculus in the summer. Yeah, not very wise. And I had three upperclassmen come to me and say, Brian, you don't take them kind of classes in the summer. You just don't. It's too much to do up here. You're going to get sidetracked. You're going to end up flunking out of school. Oh, no, I said, I'm different. I got this. Oh, then the first 2 weeks, I dropped two classes, and then with the other three classes, five classes, really? Calculus and physics in the summertime? Yeah, not smart. I was so embarrassed.
Yeah, it's still such an achievement to be able to go to school at, you know, at that young age. You said there were great concerts there.
There was a group called Nickels. Styx came through. Rod Stewart came through. I saw Minnie Riperton and George Benson, Chaka Khan, Rick James, oh, what's the other crazy guy with a Parliament P. Funkadunk, Dr. Funkenstein. Not Parliament came through, but Dr. Funkenstein came through.
Okay.
And it was just group after group. And that's just some of them because the Mississippi River Festival was there back then.
Right.
Okay. And you know, at being a paper boy, I had saved up money. So that meant I had my own car, I had money. And that didn't help the issue either. So it wasn't so much a culture shock because even though the blacks and whites... you ever seen a school that's segregated, but everybody get along?
Yeah.
It's not this bad. They say it's still some of it up there, but not like it was. But back then, it was really badly segregated, and you would still be in the classroom. Blacks were here and whites was here.
Wow.
And when you went out the room, I mean, they commingled, but it still was that separation was there.
Mm-hmm.
And the teachers were professors. They weren't pretty much, to me, interested in helping you. They would tell you, this is college. I'm here to present the information to you. It's up to you whether or not you want to get it. Mm-hmm. You know, if you need help with your homework, that's what the tutors are for.
Right.
You didn't even ask them questions.
Right.
You know,
what about the community of Edwardsville itself? Like, did you feel anything coming from Venice to Edwardsville? Were you commuting? Were you living on campus?
Yeah, actually, that was the first time I ever was taking a bus to school until I got my car. Because I wasn't allowed to drive to school when the bus was there in the summertime, my father let me take my car. But the difference I noticed when I was up there from going to Venice was. Venice was like a little small-time school. If you watch Happy Days,
okay,
right, the high school with Fonzie and all them, that's kind of the way Venice was to me, you know. And then, but when I got up to SIU, it was all these people from all these different places, black and white, and I actually could talk to any of them. That's how I ended up with the little entourage, because Upward Bound was these... desegregated. It had blacks and whites in there. And so I guess just being a smart ass, for lack of a better word, that ain't bad. Is it?
No.
I don't know, I felt more empowered than anything when I got up there. You know, the stuff that I learned and the people I dealt with in Venice just basically carried over to up there. You know, dealing with all the people on my paper route and everything. I didn't have no problem talking to anybody. Mm-hmm. One of the things when I was a junior still here in Venice, we had put on we had to pay for the seniors prom, right? And so we had to go to all these different stores to solicit advertisements and stuff. And I was one of the people brought back one of the biggest payloads. And all the proprietors of these establishments were white. So as a young black individual asking for money, you had to... Oh, yeah. Being a paper boy, hey, everything became relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I went up to SIU, I used everything I had learned here in Venice. So how my dad put it, whether the situation that you grow up in be good or be bad, learn from as much of it as you can, right? You know, and incorporate it to help you learn how to deal with issues of life. If you don't ever... get exposed to bigotry and racism, you'll never know how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
So when I had left SIU, when I flunked out, I went over to ITT Tech, Bailey Technical School, for architecture engineering. Now, St. Louis, that's a culture shock. Most racist city to this day that I've ever been in, second to London.
Mm.
You know, London is the most racist city I've ever been in, and St. Louis is number two. And everything about when I was over in St. Louis is just constantly on a daily basis was racism, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a job. I got fired off a job because of racism, you know. The white guy, he came in and he had the easy side. And he did his little work and went and sat down. I had the hard side. The next day, I got the easy side. Got done, went and sat down. They wanted me to go out and help the little white guy. Okay, I told them, you didn't have him help me. Why should I go help him? So they said I was disgruntled and not a team player and fired me. And the union They want no part of it.
Right.
Yay for union. Now, I believe in unions, but all unions aren't good unions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then I end up working for O'Brien Corporation. Here's bigotry and racism again. Only black at this whole company.
This was in St. Louis.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Owned by a Jewish guy. And so was the gas station I got fired from. But anyway, at O'Brien Corporation, I was part-time because I was working. I was still going to school. And they said once I graduated, they would hire me full-time. Well, not only did they not hire me full-time, they hired five other people around me. They had an engineering department. They did exactly what I went to school for. They hired an engineer's assistant. And so I went and talked directly to Mr. O'Brien. Now, you didn't invite me to your house. I'd have been to your house with picnics and everything else. But yet, you didn't make your employees keep your promise. Yeah, when you graduate, Brian, I got a full-time position for you. And dealing with that racism, and when I went out looking for a job, the amount of racism that I dealt with in St. Louis was more than I could stand. Because coming from Venice, everything was low-key compared to St. Louis.
Mm.
St. Louis, blatant and in your face, is systematic.
Mm-hmm.
And it works to perfection over there. And I left. That's when I joined the service. I had to get away from this area.
So you came back to the area a little, you know, you're in Granite City now.
They made me come back.
They made you come back?
The military made me come back.
Okay. When you look at Venice now, compared to when you grew up,
mm-hmm.
what are your thoughts about it?
Say it.
Why?
Because the deterioration of the city, there's no infrastructure here as far as money's coming in to rebuild the city. If you can't rebuild a city or do anything if the people don't have jobs, you don't have a tax base, you know, you don't have a business base. They took the school out, so there's no school here. There's basically nothing here from what I remember growing up. And now their Mayor Eccles is, I think, doing a very commendable job of trying to revitalize this area. I look at the park over here, which looks really, really nice compared to what it did 15 years ago. You know, and I know the people that's working trying to revitalize this area. So I also know the developers that they brought through to want to redevelop this area here, because Venice was really a really nice town to grow up in. Between the even though it was black and whites, all lived to me in harmony. You know, the prejudice that was here, easy to tolerate, very little bigotry, very little racism that I had to deal with. I can't speak for others. This is just, you know, my father said I used to look at the world through rose-colored glasses, you know. I look for things now for truth. They are what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And this city, the potential is still here. And what I like to see in areas like this, when a house becomes dilapidated and it becomes unoccupied, you just clear off the land and let it sit till revitalization time comes around, okay? Redevelopment. So this is what I see for this city coming up. But there are still key, landmarks. Thank you. Mm-hmm. That's why. This is a landmark. The library is a landmark. There are some houses down here when you first come over to Vidoc.
Mm-hmm.
When you look over there, those houses are as beautiful as they've ever been. It basically sets the tempo for what people should expect from the rest of the city. And that's what I would like to see. Hopefully, the revitalization of this area. That's what I would like to see. All the houses in this city look like those.
Mm.
And people take that kind of pride in their property, you know. So hopefully that would bring back schools and businesses and stuff like that. I would like to see a resurgence of this area. I really would.
What's so you mentioned the high school closed in 2004 because of the base for...
It wasn't enough people that went to that school to justify the building being as old as it is and mm-hmm. trying to keep it open for the number. It just economically wasn't feasible. I mean, and you know, when they say dollars and cents, it's also dollars and cents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it just wasn't feasible to keep it open anymore.
Yeah. One last question. What's your favorite memory of growing up in Venice?
My favorite memory.
Because looking back, you have, you know, a great story.
I didn't want to graduate high school. I had too much fun. Favorite memory of Venice. I don't know. I guess living in a projects, because I didn't want to move out of projects either. When my parents bought their house, I never did warm up to that house. It was just something about the environment and the projects where when you walk out the door, you got your friends to the left, to the right, in front and in back. You know, it's just kids everywhere, you know. And so all of us playing in Venice Home, they had that field back there where we would go and make hideouts and forts and climb up in trees and, you know, climb up on roofs, BB guns, model cars. I mean, it goes on and on and on about some of my fondest memory living in Venice. I just have to say when I lived in the Venice Homes, I loved all my friends and all the people that grew up over there.
Nice.
The projects, when you say projects now, people look at it in a negative sense. I make jokes about the projects and sometimes people get mad, but I tell people my memories of projects has always been fun. The number of people that you knew and met, you know, yeah, you might have to fight a little bit or whatever, you know, because always power struggle, you know. But basically you fought, and then after the fight was over, you just go back and start playing all over again, you know. There wasn't no killing or nothing like that, you know. So I have to say, and then I got three brothers, you know. And then between my brothers and my friends, we were everywhere on our bikes. And that's what I'm saying. When we drove around Venice, you didn't get nobody throwing nothing at you, looking at you sideways or nothing like that. Matter of fact, a lot of times our white friends say, hey, wait a minute, we're going to go get our bike and we come join you, you know. So, you know, and it didn't matter whether we was on this side of town or that side of town or even over here. It just didn't matter when I lived here in Venice. So the social change in Venice was not as ugly and blatant as a lot of areas. I now reside in Granite City. The change that's going on up there is getting pretty ugly. The property values are dropping. That breeds anger in people because now you're not getting the monies out of your property when you need to reinvest when you move on, you know. And then I don't care who moves into an area as long as you conduct yourself like you got some sense and take care of your property. I don't care what color you are. I remember when I first moved to Granite, my house is, I got 2 acres of property and it's a two-story house. Most of the houses are one story. So I was a black in an all-white area of the town, and they didn't make me feel welcome. Whenever I was in my yard, once again, they used the old subtle way. Traffic would go in both directions. For as long as I was out in my yard, people staring at me, letting me know they didn't appreciate me being up there. But because of the way I take care of my property and what I've done to my property, the people all of a sudden say, we don't mind you being here. And they actually stop and tell me that. And that's pretty offensive. Because what do I care that you agree with, that you don't mind me being here or you approve of what I'm doing to my property? That's my property. But I just got told that just 4 weeks ago. A husband and wife turned around, came back, pulled up on the side while I was edging my yard and told me, you know, we really approve of what you've done in your property. And we think it's really pretty, a job well done. And I'm like, thank you. Because I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, lady, what do I care? You know, but I'm trying to be nice. I'm like, really? You simply could have said your property looks nice and, you know, because there's people, and this is what I'm talking about. People come by once a year, even if they live out of town, because that used to be just a vacant, ugly field. And they come by my property once a year to see what I've done with it and take pictures.
Wow.
So should I be flattered or insulted?
Right.
But I know the issue behind it is bigotry, you know. And I just laugh it off because I'm like, to a lot of people, ignorance is bliss, and I just chalk it off as that. But you'll never learn. But if you step out and you talk to me and you give me 5 minutes, I'll change your perception of black people.
Right.
And that's how I deal with racism. That's what I learned from growing up in Venice.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome.